Okay. He has an honours degree in computing science and psychology. He's worked at the CSIRO for 2 years doing research in multimedia. He's a software engineer for the Adelaide-based Rising Sun Pictures, working on CineSync, a fine program that really helps tons of people in the visual effects industry. He always wanted to be into something to do with computers and entertainment, of course, even from a very young age. So obviously where he is at the moment is very much suited to him. He believes that math can be as beautiful as nature or supermodels, although I'm not sure he's really serious about that one. With some of my students who believe math was beautiful. He also believes that computational thinking is an essential skill for future generations to learn, and that virtual worlds will become an integral part of society within 15 years, just as the World Wide Web is today. I think he's probably right there. He is currently living in Sydney, one of the most beautiful, of course, cities in the world. A bit expensive, otherwise. Okay, who else could it be? The one and only Andre Pang.
Hello.
Ooh, echo.
Hey, sorry, now you missed the 5 minutes of all that.
So, when you're writing threaded code, it looks something like this. You lock, you change your variable, you do unlock. It doesn't seem too hard. Well, let's start with a few war stories from our particular community, from some fairly well-known people. So, does anybody recognize this person here coming up? Yeah? All right, so his name is Alan Cox. Once, some time ago, he said a computer is a state machine. Threads are for people who can't program state machines. Let's start off with another esteemed member of our community. Anybody recognize the person in the middle? I hope so. His name is Andrew Tridgell. He gave a great talk, a keynote last year at LCA about the software engineering. So here's what Andrew has to say about threads. First, he said threads are evil. Right. And then he talked about using alternatives to using threads. So, for instance, you know, it's pretty normal in the Unix world to use processes instead of threads. What does he say about processes? The processes are ugly. This is verbatim from his talk. Okay. What about using state machines? State machines send you mad. So, what do you decide to do in the end for stand before? Stand before. Choose your own combination of evil, ugly, and mad. Right? So the point here is that all of these solutions are not really particularly satisfactory for us as developers. We have this pretty hard problem. So let's move on from Andrew. This is a great quote from a guy named Todd Hoff, I think. I recall how I took a lock in a data structure that when the system scaled up in size lasted 100 milliseconds too long, caused backups and queues throughout the system, deadly cascades of drops and message retries. I can recall having a common memory library as an endless source of priority inversion problems, and the same issues came up over and over again. Deadlock, corruption, priority inversion, performance problems, impossibility of new people to understand how the system works. This is the important bit. So here's a summary of things. After a long and careful analysis, the results are clear. 11 out of 10 people can't handle threats. He wrote this in a little article on his website called The Solution to C++ Threading in Erlang, which I'll obviously be talking about a little bit in this. So in light of all this, why do we need threads? Well, this is one reason why. Why do we need concurrency in general? This thing is a Sunfire T2000. It has, you know, a couple of cores in there, like 32 of them. So reason number one you want to use actually be concurrent is, well, to get performance and scalability. You know, they're slightly different things, but I'm going to put them under the same umbrella for the time being. It's a much bigger challenge to write server code, you know, for things like Apache and Samba to support all 32 cores and just to support one or even two. So this is, you know, the machine I'm using. It's a MacBook Pro. It's got two cores. So you're thinking, well, okay, I write desktop apps. I'll be okay. This is mostly for server people and, you know, kind of a subset of programmers. Well, you're going to be in big trouble in the next 7 years because this is what the graph for the next 7 years is going to look like. Right now, we're seeing 2007, so estimated end of this year, we're going to have four cores in standard desktop processors. In, you know, just 5 years' time, you should have in 2012, we're going to have 32. You're going to, this is the kind of systems we'll be dealing with in 5 years. And are we prepared for this? Do programming languages give us the kind of capability that we need to solve, you know, the concurrency problem? Basically, no. So now let's talk about something else, about an industry which has had to deal with this kind of problems for the last couple of years already. Anybody want to take a guess at what that is? Like performance and, you know, dealing with lots of scalability issues? Yeah? Telecoms is one? I want to pick a more fun one. I want to talk about games.
Yeah.
Games are cool, right? Games are cool. So I'll show you a quick video of something which was released this year. This is Erlang, that's right. No, this is still code in C++. The game called Company of Heroes. This footage you're watching here is in-game engine footage from the game, and this is how fast it runs in my damn box. All right. It runs really quick. So that's not a pre-rendered movie. That's actually in-game animation. And this is out this year with the kind of, you know, of units that are coming out next year and the year after that. We have the Xbox 360 coming out. Here's one. It's got three PowerPC cores, 3 gigahertz each, right? Here's a PlayStation 3. PlayStation 3 is, hang on, one main PowerPC core and six, I think, synergistic processing elements, they call it, which are like vector processors that run at 3 gigahertz. Okay, so we've got, you know, just seven processors on this thing so far. Here's a GeForce 8800 GTX. It's a beautiful piece of work. This thing here has 128 pipelines, all right? They're running at 1.3 gigahertz each. This is an enormous amount of power, and this is exactly what the games industry has had to deal with for the last, you know, couple of years, well, last year or two, basically, because they want to make games. The game life cycle is so long that when they're working with this equipment, you know, it's going to come out a year later or something. So they really, really have to optimize. And, of course, people are going to complain like hell if the game's running at 5 frames a second or something really slow. So they have to deal with this. So what do games people have to say about this? Anybody know who this guy is? He wrote a really reasonably popular game called Doom and Quake and stuff. So John Carmack, if you want to utilize all of that unused performance, it's going to become more of a risk to you and bring pain and suffering to the programming side. John Carmack's a pretty bright guy by any measure, I would think, you know, partial rocket scientist and all that. So he's having trouble with this. I want to introduce somebody else. This guy's name is Tim Sweeney. He wrote something called the Unreal Engine, which is probably the most successful gaming engine in use today. It's used in over 50 games, from stuff is from a variety of games to from first-person shooters to even MMORPGs, real-time strategy games. So, for instance, the Unreal Engine is used in Lineage 2, I think, which is really popular in Korea, which is not bad considering it was kind of designed originally around being a first-person shooter engine. All right. So he's, in my opinion, one of the best game architects and designers around the industry. The fact that it's been used in over 50 games and lots of applications apart from it is a really good sign. He's also very good with programming, with his programming language theory and knows a lot about it. You think Guido Van Rossum knows a lot. This guy trumps him way, way better. So what does Tim have to say about shared state concurrency, which is the model that we use today? Basically, the way we do it in C, C++, Java, it's really hard. They use one main thread. They have a couple of helper threads to do it, so it's a dynamic pool of threads. They program really carefully, and this is basically the best that they can do right now and the best method that they found. It scales poorly. You know, they're struggling on the PlayStation 3. The Unreal Engine 3 is meant to be aimed at sustaining games until about 2010, so that's around 16 cores that they have to deal with. So even then, it's not really optimized to take all the advantage of of future computers. This is the real problem. Here's what they have to deal with. You've got thousands of objects in these games. Every single one of them contains mutable state. each one is updated, 30, 60, 100 times a second, you know, for graphics redrawing and AI and everything else. Every update touches 5 to 10 other objects. Put yourself in the situation as programmers in key. Imagine trying to scale this kind of problem to using, like, more than even just one processor, throwing blocks around what exactly do you parallelize? So basically, Tim's just saying, he gave this talk at a programming languages conference, the most distinguished in the world, called Puffle. And he was invited to talk there because of his experience in game design and his programming languages experience. And he's basically saying that the current way of doing things, shared state concurrency, is hopelessly intractable. And hopelessly intractable is another word for, you know, we're screwed, right? So he has two interesting solutions to this. One, you know, if you're a Haskell fan, you'll be like, woohoo, rewrite as referentially transparent functions. The second one is message passing concurrency, which is, of course, the way that OLang does things. So here is one possible solution to this. You know this book, The Mythical Man Month? If you don't know it, you should. It's by Fred Brooks. There's a quote in there saying, surely the most powerful stroke for software productivity, reliability, and simplicity has been the progressive use of higher-level languages for programming. Now, there's been a lot of debate about whether programming languages, in particular, centered around Haskell, can solve, you know, the inherent complexity problem. The argument is basically that no matter how good a language you've got, programming is complex. We deal with complex problems. They can't solve everything. You're always going to have a bit of complexity left over. Well, let me talk about OLang for a little bit, and, you know, we'll see what new kinds of possibilities that a new programming language or new programming language paradigm can bring. So it's like, the language is named actually after a guy named A.K. OLang, who is a mathematician who, funny enough, invented Turing theory, which is quite related to that, and apparently the duality between that and the fact that it was invented by something named Ericsson is quite incidental, and he thought it was quite cute. So here's some OLang code. Nothing like diving straight into code. Here's how you write hello world. You have a hello function, and we've got a module named I.O., and there's a function in the I.O. module named format, which is similar to printf. So you just write hello world, and then they use a tilde instead of a backslash for their stuff because, you know, the Swedish and Swedish people are different. So here's how you say hello to somebody in particular. You have a function which takes in one variable called name. Variables in OLang start with a capital letter. Then you go hello, and you write tilde s, and then you put name afterwards, and this is the syntax for list. So if you add more stuff here, you know, tilde s, another tilde s, you just chuck more things in the list, and it all goes. Here's how you write hello world concurrently in OLang. This is, OLang's got a lot of nice primitives for making basically spawning new tasks and threads and processes really, really easy. So this this is a full-blown OLang module. You can type this into CRLC, the compiler, and it'll run. So this module is called hello concurrent. It's got three functions, receiver, giver, and start. Now, receiver takes in no arguments, that's why the receiver slash zero up there. Giver takes one, and start takes in no arguments. So that's just the OLang syntax for referring to a function. So let's start with start. There's a inbuilt function in OLang called spawn. Spawn takes a module name, a function name, and a list of arguments that you pass to it. So here, you're saying give us the current module name, the receiver function, and an empty list because it doesn't take any arguments. So all this does is just start this with this receiver function on a different thread. Right? Very, very simple. That's how you start a thread in OLang. It's so much easier than, you know, pthreads and other wacky stuff like that. So after it starts that, it starts off another function in the current module. So there's another spawn, so hello concurrent, and then it starts this giver process, and it passes it the process ID or the receiver. Okay? Then it just says, okay, now I'm done, and it just quits. So it's these two things in the background, and then it just exits. So let's have a look first at the receiver. There's the way you use threads in OLang is only via message passing. There is no data that is shared between threads. Right? You can't do it in this language. So one of the core primitives, so apart from spawn, you've got this exclamation mark thing, and there's another thing called receive. Receive is something which says, okay, I'm going to block on this thread for now, and I'm just going to wait for a message from anybody else. Right. So here, if you get a receive message, and the message is die die die, which is just like an identifier in OLang, then you just return OK. In other words, you exit, and then that receiver thread will die. If you don't get a die die message, OLang's got pattern matching for those who are familiar with functional languages. So here you say that if you receive something of the form of a tuple, this is the syntax for a tuple here with two elements. Here if you receive a tuple and the first identifier bit is called name, and the second bit can be anything you want. Remember that variables in our language is capital letter. Then this prints out hello and whoever the name was. So when you get a message saying, here's somebody's name, print it out on the screen. So here's giver, it takes in the receiver's PID, and it just sends it a message. So this is a syntax for sending a message. You just send a tuple of name and hello Andre and hello limits.com.au, then you tell it to die. All right. This is all the Erlang code I'm actually going to go into in this talk, because I think if you're interested in it, you can learn about it yourself. This gives you an idea, though, of how easy process creation and sending messages back and forth between processes are. Oh, sorry, yes, I should have pointed that out. When the receiver receives a message, first it prints it out, and then the way you re-enter the function in Erlang is to use recursion because it's a functional language. So you just call it itself again, and then it just starts again. So it just basically sits there in a loop all the time until it just receives die, die, die. Yeah.
Is the only way to kill a thread like that by having it away from it to tell it to die?
I think you can forcibly kill it, but it's not done often at all. Usually it's much better for the thread to sit in its own, to sit in a receive loop, and then you tell it to die, because then it dies in a much more control, it can close down, shut itself down cleanly. So, yeah, I mean, it's the same, all the same dangers as using, P3 cancel and all that kind of evil stuff.
Is that using more stack each time you recursive?
No, Erlang being a functional language, tell recursion is very, very important for pretty much all functional languages. So while you guys probably see this as recursion, it is not actually going to create a stack that, goes to like 10,000 deep. It realizes this is a tell call and will just do proper tell recursion on it so you don't have a stack that grows. Move on to the next slide. To give you an idea of Erlang's threading capabilities, here's a little graph. On the graph, we've got on the bottom axis the number of concurrent connections, and on the vertical axis is you've got the number of kilobytes per second. So here we're comparing Apache versus yours, which is yours is the Erlang web server. So here you've got 90,000 current connections. I think they tested only up to 80,000. So how does Apache do? Apache over local keeps up with yours pretty well somewhere around 3,000 or 4,000. Then it just dies. It just will refuse to send any more data. Over NFS, the performance is even suckier. Look at yours running over NFS, and it's superb. It's still serving pretty much the same speed at 80,000 threads as it is at zero with a bit more, standard deviation, that's all. But the interesting bit here is that this 80,000 concurrent connections is actually handled in one Erlang thread each, right? Because the idea of Erlang is to make, well, what happens if you make concurrency easy? A whole lot of new things opens up. We'll talk about this in a second. The way this works is that, remember Java, when it came out, had this thing called green threads, and everybody was sort of like, what the hell is green threads? They just use a land. Here's why green threads are good. You can have 50,000 of them running with no performance problems whatsoever because you are not kernel context switching back all the time, right? So the Erlang VM, just the new one, especially runs on SMP. So if you've got 80,000 threads running, and you've got eight processes, it will do the smart thing and, distribute about 10,000 threads to each of them. So it takes care of all the scheduling for you. The latest release did change some small semantics and some Erlang functions, but mostly stuff ran fine, like ejabberd, which is a pretty popular Jabber server written in Erlang. They had to update the code a little bit, but it wasn't too bad at all, and they got SMP support basically for free. And it runs on a Sun. There was another graph. I didn't include it in here because I thought I'd run out of time. But there's another graph I've got here showing that Sunfire 2000 machine, they ran it Erlang on that thing, and it scales to the 32 processes on there just fine. It's nearly linear. It's quite scary how good it is. So let's go back to our war story slides for a bit. Now, what if we turn this on its head and say, what if we made threading really, really easy, like Erlang does? What, say, if concurrent programming was not hard, and you didn't have the headaches associated with it, and it's cheap to create new threads, so you can just do it at your whim? This actually gives you a whole model of programming, because normally, if you look at a scene like this, so this is a scene from Company of Heroes, the game I showed you before. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if, say, we could just actually run these things on our own thread and not have to worry about locking, not have to worry about any concurrency issues? So every single object in here, you know, from the sandbag to like the soldier over here, if they can just run in their own thread, it maps onto the problem space so much better. So this is the third hidden reason why you want concurrency. Very few people talk about this. They're all like, stay away from threads, which is very sound advice given our current, you know, the way we do threads at the moment. But concurrency does have a lot of advantages. Just like how, say, dynamic loading allows you to use plugins and programs and radically change the design of a lot of programs, if you can get 5,000, 20,000 threads running, maybe, you know, you can tackle your problem in a totally different way, make things much, much more stable. So LLM's got a couple of other interesting features. Because it's quite an industrial language, functional languages are often criticized for being too academic, you know, not used in the real world. LLM actually comes with a lot of industrial tools to help you with this. For one thing, there's a very good crash dump viewer. So LLM doesn't crash. I've rarely ever seen the VM crash. The only time I've ever seen it crash is when we forgot to add swap space to our system and it ran out of memory, which we quickly solved. But, you know, if the thread basically, you know, does something invalid, like say if it receives a message and it doesn't know how to interpret it because you haven't supplied a case for it, it'll go, okay, you know, I'll throw an exception and the thread will die in a controlled manner. When it does that, you'll get a crash dump, which you can view with this web, very nice web-based viewer. So all this code is actually running on a separate machine and you can just, like, view the crash dump viewer on the remote host, and that all works very, very nicely. And you can see here that, for instance, we had a problem in our logging module, and we're using a little bit too much space because I think I had a function going wrong and it was incidentally recursing on itself, something like that. But yeah, so it's a very nice crash dump viewer. It's got hot code reloading, so basically reloading code for the application itself. Any of you guys seen Andrew Trigil's chess night talk where he? Yep. Okay, so the idea here is that, you know, you got bits of your code that you want to upgrade on the fly because you found some bugs in it, it's running, you know, a live system 24/7, you don't want to take it down. How do you implement hot code reloading? Do you want to do this in C++, even Java? It's a real pain. Erlang, that's how you do it. You can use ERL, which is the Erlang shell, and tell it to SSH into the Erlang onto the remote machine, so it just does that. You get an Erlang prompt, you say, purge this mod, purchase particular module, and then just reload it. And if there are any modules left in memory which are still executing code, the Erlang virtual machine will take care of this. It'll just keep the old code running until all the last things that use it drop out, and then it'll load in a new one. So, yep.
What happens if the call to module name happens while just after you purge it but before you load the next one?
The programming language has two different syntaxes for calling functions in your own module. So normally if you just put in the function name by itself, it'll use the currently running module. If you put in a module name colon function name, so you refer back to yourself explicitly, that's sort of instruction to tell it, okay, switch to code using from the new module. So because each process does not store its own internal state at all, this is not a problem. If you want to store stuff to disk or anything like that, Erlang comes with a really nice thing called Amnesia. Amnesia is a distributed.
Sorry, Andre, I think he was asking between those two lines of code. For a while there, the module doesn't actually exist, right? You purged it.
Oh, I understand. If you do a code purge and before you do the load file, the next time that any function from that module is used, VM will just detect it and load it for you automatically. So strictly speaking, you can just do a code purge and just let it go along its way, and it'll reload it itself, which is, you know, kind of nice. So onto Amnesia. Amnesia is Erlang's very nice distributed database. Keep in mind, there are very many free ones around. There's a couple of nice things about it. One of the great things about Amnesia is that this whole object relational mapping garbage, you know, SQL rows and columns are mapped to objects and all that kind of stuff, that all goes away because it's part of the language. So you can store Erlang terms like atoms, lists, tuples, all that kind of thing directly in the database. There's no, you know, you don't have to convert it to some crazy SQL thing. It doesn't even use SQL because Erlang being a functional language, if you want to do a query in your database, you can. There's a whole bunch of query functions you can use, of course, but you can just use list comprehension if you're familiar with Python or any other, or Haskell or something. Yeah, I mean, SQL is basically a subset of list comprehension, so why not just use the full power instead, right? So being part of the language is really, really nice. One of the cool things I like about it from a, you know, nice design point of view is that a transaction in this database is done by running this transaction function in the Amnesia module. You just pass it a function to do stuff, and it will go and run it. This being a functional language, you can pass functions with source class values everywhere. So here's a function, for instance, just to write, you know, the password that I specified, which is, this is the syntax from the Erlang record. It's similar to struct in C, and it takes, and yeah, so it says, writes a record with an index name of pass, in the database name called password, and just write that particular record to it, your user, and that's it. So it's only these three lines that you have to have. All this stuff is just to, you know, start Amnesia, create the tables and stuff. And you can configure Amnesia through a web module, so you can just load up your web browser, configure it that way, and it will, you can tell it whether Node should store data to disk, whether it should only keep stuff in RAM. The functions in Amnesia to do what they call dirty writes, which in which case, you know, if you're not, if you don't care that you lose that particular bit of data that you want to write, you can do a dirty write, which is much, much faster, and it'll replicate it to all the other nodes that you've got sometime later, and, you know, ensure consistency that way. So Amnesia is also distributed and scalable. You can add new nodes on the fly. When you add a new node, you can programmatically say, okay, whenever I add a new node, you should just copy all your current data, copy a new node. You can also say stuff like, you know, only certain nodes have certain bits of data in there. But the scale's fine. We're using it right now with 3 servers worldwide, not even on the same LAN. So we've got one in Australia, one in London, and one in Texas. And it works fine. We have not had a single crash on our servers for, I think, over a year since I found out about that swap issue, which is rather embarrassing. But yeah, it looks really, really well. The other big key ingredient about Erlang, which a lot of people don't talk about, is it has, I'm going to use the word self-healing here because hopefully you all went to Andrew Tannenbaum's keynote on Wednesday. Erlang is basically a self-healing system. The key with this is not so much that, you know, it makes it easy to create new threads and create new processes and all that kind of stuff. The key is that it gives you a whole architecture to write your massive server programs in. So this diagram that you're seeing here, this is from the what they call the Open Telecoms platform, which is just a fancy branding for their libraries, right? But they have a couple of design guidelines saying, you know, write your programs like this. So instead of you writing your code as you normally do, the Open Telecoms platform gives you the whole framework for things like servers, state machines, you know, talking to networks and stuff like that, and you supply callbacks for it, and it will, you know, you, that's how you supply all your logic. I guess business logic, if you want to use that word. You plug it into that system, and that is what keeps the whole thing ticking. So what you can see there is what they call a supervision tree. Because processes are so cheap to create in Erlang, instead of, you know, creating a process to do a certain task, they just create two. One to actually do the task, another one to monitor it if it dies. And if it dies, the supervisor process lets everybody else know and restarts it. So just as, you know, what Tannenbaum said in his talk about, if you have a network card driver that dies, just restart it. Erlang does exactly the same thing, does it right now, gives you a full framework for doing things. So that's a very nice self-healing architecture. So where's Erlang actually used? What you're looking at here is an Ericsson AXD301. This is something that telcos tend to plug into their main phone switches for, you know, the United States and Asia and all that kind of thing. It handles an insane amount of traffic. I'm not sure what kind of hardware is driving it, but I do know that it's, I think, about 2 million lines of Erlang code driving this thing, right? So we're not talking about an academic language here. It's actually used a lot in real life every day. The impressive thing about this is that they're just using the standard Erlang technologies. Amnesia is actually used for the network routing and phone number database in there. And so the other thing I forgot to mention about Amnesia is that it's soft real-time. Not hard real-time. Having a hard real-time database would be pretty cool. But it's stuff real time, which is pretty damn good. So when you are dialing a phone number, that's Amnesia doing lookups every time you type in a digit, right? So that was one of the constraints of the telecoms industry. This was partially written for that, pretty much to get a competitive advantage in our industry versus everybody else. So, the other thing I forgot to mention is that Amnesia, I think, is about 30,000 lines of Erlang code. For distributed database, that's not too bad. I don't know what MySQL and you know, Oracle and DB2 and stuff are, but I think they're probably bigger than 30,000 lines. So in a more practical example that's closer to all of us, let's have a look at eJabberD, which is a pretty popular Java server these days, mostly because, you know, Jabber.org is running they got fed up with the crashes, performance levels and stuff of Jabberdee. They were using, I think, Jabberdee 2 for a little while, and then they kind of just gave up and went, all right, stuff, we're using eJabberdee because we heard lots of good things about it. Let's give it a shot. Well, here's what eJabberdee is currently handling. The top graph that you see is the number of concurrent connections from clients. So it handles 10,000 clients. This is running on a single machine, 80 other server connections, and the load average isn't too bad. I'm spiking up every hour, I guess, so every 2 hours, I guess, it's doing backups or something. But, you know, load average is sitting at, you know, 0.1, 0.2 most of the time, having 10,000 connections and 80 other servers. This is the main Jabber hub. Sorry? 800 servers, apologies, not 80. So this is doing, you know, all your Gmail talk, Google talk proxying and all that kind of stuff. So this is all, eJabberdee is written online. Again, it's running on a single node, right? It's a pretty, well, by today's standards, it's not actually that beefy a machine anymore. I think it's it was a 2 or 3 gigahertz Xeon with 2 gigs of RAM. Mostly for lots of connections, you want RAM. That's all, because all I need, well, if you want to handle 10,000 connections, you got no choice but to add a bit more system memory, all right? And 2 gigs is pretty reasonable for that. But yeah, you can see that, you know, the VM scales pretty well. And again, it's using, for each of these users that are connected, it's using one thread each. You know.
Andre, if you have 10,000 threads, do they, I mean, is the operating system scheduling those threads somehow?
No, that's why Erlang uses the green thread model. So they're all scheduled by the Erlang VM. And if you've got multiple processes, it'll just run one user process for each processor that you've got.
Okay, I was just going to ask on the impact on the scheduler. Obviously, there's none.
Sorry?
I was going to ask on what impact that has on the scheduler, but...
Yeah, that's the whole point of Erlang is to say, well, we're just using user space threads because kernel threads are just far too expensive. Right. Ingo Molnar has done some fantastic work in making the Linux kernel scale to like 40,000 threads, but you don't need it, and honestly, Erlang's still a hell of a lot faster. There were tests where it could run, I think they got it running on the Opteron 64 with 16 gigs of memory, and it went up to 200,000 threads, no problem. Mike?
You sort of touched on this, but didn't give any details. When you're handling 10,000 connections, you're going to need a lot of memory. How much memory will an Erlang thread take?
I think
before you start doing anything interesting with it.
I think it's 300 bytes.
Okay, so they really are very, very cheap.
They're pretty cheap, yeah.
Because I've run into this with other software I've written where the moment you start doing anything interesting, you run out of address space.
Yeah. I actually got, because I was procrastinating doing these slides a little while ago, I actually did some benchmarks. Anybody here know stackless Python? How many Python programmers here? Okay, this is good. I'll be talking about it a tiny bit later on. But stackless Python is a variant of Python which gives you sort of this, what they call the AFTER model. This is the whole message passing concurrency system, right? So stackless Python does that, and it's much, much slower than Erlang. Threads are much more expensive in it. So Erlang is really designed from the start to be extremely cheap threading from free. You know, 300 bytes per thread is really not a huge amount at all. So going back to this slide now, in light of all this, here's the message I want to get across today. You see this code? Just say no. Don't do it. Dead state concurrency is bad. You know, we had, I think our code base is not that large. It's about 35,000 lines now for the application, the main program that I write at work. And we needed to run a background thread because we had to do some disk IO and we didn't want to block the user interface and all that. So we started doing this, and you know, I learned about Erlang beforehand. We're using Erlang on the server, and because we're writing in C++, it was like, well, we should just do it, you know, the old style way. And we started doing this, and then I got to about halfway through the code, saw how many locks and unlocks I needed to do, and then I just went, nah, stop this. And I just wrote my own message passing system in C. It's not very hard. You just need a way to signal back to the main thread, which you usually do by the GUI event loop or something, and then, you know, just pass the messages back and tell the main thread what to do. So, yeah, don't do this. Don't do this. Just say no to shared state concurrency. So if you're using one of the existing languages, C, C++, that's apparently a new Python logo. I found it on the Beta Python website. I think it's cute. Java. If you're using C, obviously step one, move to a better language if you can. C sucks for doing pretty much anything application development oriented. All right. C++ is a ton better in that regard, I'll say, you know, and I'm completely confident in that now that I've used it a lot. You can write some unreadable code in it, but you can write some, there are so many things that you can do with C++ to make your life easier as a programmer. There's a very, very good article by a guy named Andrei Alexandrescu, Anybody heard of him here at all? Okay, so that's probably, these will be the hardcore C++ programmers in the room. He wrote a fantastic article on, well, basically a really neat hack on using the volatile qualifier to enforce compiler-checked locking or mutex locking of variables, right? So you cannot access the variable unless you specifically say lock first, and when you lock it, it uses the C++ RAII idiom to make sure that when you fall out of your current scope, it will unlock it for you automatically, so there's no forgetting about unlocking this variable. If you have an exception, if you have an exception or something, it will also take care of that and unlock it properly as well. So I'll send you, I'll put up some references for all this stuff later on. If you're using C, you know, try, you can write your own small message passing system in that. If you're writing in C, you're reinventing the wheel every time anyway. If you're using Python, check out Stackless Python. It's really neat. It adds it's a variation of Python. It's maintained up to the current Python release. It adds a lot of the message passing stuff that you saw with, you know, so spawn and sending messages and stuff become primitives, and it makes threads really cheap. It has user land threads as well, just like Erlang does. Not quite as good, but if you're using Python, you know, it's a really solid bet. EVE Online, which was a pretty popular MMORPG game, uses Stackless Python on the server and in the client. So it's also battle tested, which is nice. If you're using Java, have a look at Java Spaces or one of the other sort of new Web 2.0 type Java things to try and make your life easier with that. I've got a whole stack of business cards here. You're welcome to pick some up and talk to me afterwards. But the main point is try and just use the message passing idiom, right? One thread sending a message to another thread, so much easier than shared state concurrency. I believe I'm pretty much out of time, so that's where I'm going to have to end it for the moment.
Just one quick question was, so what is Rising Sun Research working on in Erlang?
Our server stuff is written in Erlang. So we have a program that has synchronized multimedia playback across different networks. So the idea is you start up a movie player here, you start up one there, and when you hit play on this one, all of them start playing back as well and go in sync. They all talk through a central server. This is, in fact, advantages for the visual effects industry, which has pretty draconian firewalls. So all our server stuff is all Erlang. Yep.
You gave the example in the game where you said the bag and this other thing are each a thread.
Yep.
Is it really a recommended way of programming in Erlang to have pretty much every object be a thread?
It's a pretty Erlang-ish way of thinking. So our current abstractions are like, you know, well, if you need some reason to reuse some code, write another function, the Erlang approach is sort of, well, you know, if you need to solve this particular problem, can you do it with another process? If you can, just for another process, they're really cheap. As long, just make sure, you know, it maps, use whatever tools you need to map onto the problem space well, and threads often map onto the problem space well, just that we've been trained not to use threads very much, well, for good reason in this day and age.
Are there any catches to this kind of thing? Like, one of my concerns is that all this message passing is going to require lots of data to be copied around and so forth. You know, what things is not good for?
We had some problems with Erlang performance, but there are ways that, you know, if there are Erlang performance guides available, we followed those and our performance problems went away. You're right in that one thing I didn't point out in the code examples is that Erlang is a single assignment language. So it's not a pure functional language, but it means that whenever you assign something to a variable, you can't change it, right? If you want to change the variable, you just make a new variable and you know, do your algorithms or computation of that. But you have to assign it to a new one if you want to change the value. You can't actually change the value of an existing variable. It's more like a match variable in that respect. So it does do. Has a lot of intelligence. The garbage collector that runs in Erlang is in fact real time, because using it in telco systems, it has to be real time. So speed is generally not a problem with it. And usually for the kinds of applications you write Erlang for, it's not CPU that's going to limit you. It's more usually network and memory. I mean, 10,000 current connections running on the main Java server. I think you're probably limited by your network bandwidth just before it hits CPU. It was running at 0.1 load average, right?
One of the things Python's really good at is interfacing with machine code using C types and stuff like that.
Yep.
How easy is it to do that kind of thing in Erlang?
I haven't done much experimentation with it. It doesn't look that hard from what the EJabberZee guys have done. So they have, for instance, Erlang uses something called ports to to communicate with CLAN, and they wrote a port to handle like a zlib compression and SSL. It was SSL specifically, sorry. So they had a wrapper around OpenSSL to handle all the SSL stuff, and so you can have encrypted chat streams. And the code wasn't that long. It's not the a whole bunch of evil macros and stuff like that. Once you write a pretty small LA module, I think it's usually less. I think the OpenSSL one was less than 1,000 lines to do most of the work. So it doesn't seem too bad.
Right. I'll have to cut it off there because we're over time. Thank you very much, Andre. That was a very